Hi, everyone. Today is November 21st, 2013. Welcome to Neuroscientist Talk Shop, UTSA's neurobiology podcast. Our guest today is Lena Ting. She's an associate professor at the Wallace H. Coulter Department of Biomedical Engineering at Emory University in Georgia Tech. Hi, Lena.
Hello.
Hi. Her lab studies the biomechanics and neuromuscular control of posture and locomotion, as well as musculoskeletal modeling and dynamic simulation of movement. Around the room, we've got Charlie Wilson. Hi, Charlie.
Hi.
And we've got Todd Troyer.
Hello.
Hi, Todd. So I'm just going to go broad, like I always do at the very beginning. Whenever we're talking about motor control in any way, there's always this fundamental problem of taking a task-level command, like resisting a fall or pointing to an object, and translating it into sort of the high-dimensional anatomical details of muscles and joints. Mm-hmm. Can you walk us through the engineering-level understanding of this problem and expand out to how we can get from biomechanical models to understanding neural control mechanisms? There's sort of like a lot in there.
Okay, that's a tough question. I think even in robotics, it's a difficult problem in terms of specifying something that's not at the specific joint level. So traditionally, if you want to control a robot, you say move the elbow this much and move the wrist this much. And we know that in order to do the task, even in an engineering context, we have some higher level goals of reaching a particular point and not breaking something, or a lot of other things that really don't have to do with the specific anatomy of how I'm actually reaching that. Similarly, in our brains, we know that we have representations of those types of tasks that we might want to perform. And thinking about it from an engineering perspective, we have talked to a lot of people who use what's called optimal control theory to achieve those tasks, in which you say, what are all the different combinations of ways that I can achieve this goal, and then choose it based on some principle of minimizing energy or making a smooth trajectory or things like that. And while it can often produce movements and quote unquote decisions that look really biological, the sort of mathematical underpinnings of it don't really tell us how that happens in your nervous system. So what was the second part of the question?
So how do we get from these biomechanical models to understanding the neural mechanism? So basically your approach is what I'm asking for.
So the optimal control approach is really interesting in telling you what things are relatively better or worse based on some overall metric. But ultimately, you have to figure out how it's done in your body, and to kind of understand what the problem is that's posed. Why is it difficult to do these things? And my perspective was always as a mechanical engineer. So I want to start with mechanics. I want to start with what the body does. And there are some things that your body will do just based on Newtonian mechanics. So people have built these passive walking devices where they don't have any muscles and they walk down a slope and they look kind of like the legs of a human, and they do a thing that's sort of like walking. And so people have argued that you really don't need a nervous system for walking, and that really the mechanics is the hard problem. But these things, they're not very stable. But they do reveal that there are some things that we don't really have control over and other things that we do have control over. And I think it's important for us to distinguish the things that the nervous system can actually produce in your body and things that your body's going to sort of have a tendency to do on its own. And one of the things is these things fall over really easily, right? So they don't have any feedback or stability. And the other thing is that they can only walk. They can't do anything else. And one of the things that we're really good at is using our bodies in lots of different ways. So I think being able to, this idea of reconfigurability is really important, and understanding what the mechanics of the body are and what it requires to do walking versus running. Say, we know that walking is sort of like this pendular mechanics, whereas running's like bouncing like a spring. And so we have these very high level ideas about what they are, but it's the same legs. that are doing this. So when we think about muscle synergies and muscle coordination, then we have to coordinate our muscles to either act sort of like this accordion thing or act when we're running versus more of a stiff leg kind of approach when you're walking. And that's kind of how I think about the problem that your nervous system faces is how do you make a multi-articulated body act like a very simple system, like a spring or a pendulum, through controlling muscles in a particular way. So when people lose that function, then they sort of discoordination. If you look at somebody who different gait disorders, people with cerebral palsy or other spinal cord injury, then they lose that ability to reconfigure their bodies in lots of different sort of purposeful ways.
So how do you, I was just thinking when you're describing that, it seems like a lot of the task is like either the optimal control, you have to decide what to optimize, or even some tying a task kind of thing. You kind of pick your tasks and you kind of grab them out of air in some kind of intuitively motivated thing. This seems reasonable that you need to do this, or walking versus running. Is there any, I mean, but a lot of it has to, it seems like a lot of the problem is deciding what really is the task. I mean, what is the range of tasks and how to think about that problem space in any kind of systematic way? Is there any way to think about those things, or is it more useful? Is it too large to not just think about grabbing an intuitive thing and see what this tells you, or this is a good kind of an artist kind of choice of this is a good approach or that is a good approach kind of?
Yeah, so people who do optimal control usually study very simplified tasks so that they have something that they can compare to. So like from my lab before, you do something with just a biomechanical constraint, like maximum height jumping was done by Felix Zajac just to say, well, can we even predict sort of counter movement jump versus jumping without counter movement to say, okay, that's the way that you should do it. You should go down before you go up. And that's just purely biomechanical. Now, most of us, when we jump, we're not trying to jump as high as we can. And so there are lots of other factors that would affect how you do it. And so the optimal control there doesn't necessarily explain that. And it doesn't necessarily explain why if I get trained, I could jump higher, right? So I'm not really hitting an optimum. And that's one of the things you have to be careful of, that it describes a process and a way of weighting things, but it doesn't mean that our movements are optimal in that sense, depending on sort of the cost function or the variables that we impose as being important. And so looking at where your optimal control doesn't predict is really important, I think even more so than looking at what it does predict, and learning about what kind of constraints there might be on our ability to just do whatever movement pattern that we want. I don't think that it's helpful in actually learning about what the learning process might be.
Yeah. The broadest extreme is just the brain knows about every muscle and what every muscle can do and programs every muscle. And so if you were to make a list of all the different ways of doing something, it would be an enormously huge list. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the optimal controller has to hunt through this gigantic list of possible ways to do it to find the best one. And maybe just has some like cut off, and when it gets good enough, I stop. I don't have to hunt through that whole list. But the list is really huge. And the second thing I think I hear people say sometimes is that, well, the list isn't really that big because you can't, you know, rub your stomach and tap your head at the same time, and so that can, maybe you can. Some people can. So that one just can be removed from the list. And so the list is actually much shorter because of these synergies of things that have to happen together. And in that case, it sounds to the naive person like me as though, well, let's just do that. Let's just make the list of the things that you can do at the same time. The same way the optimal controller has to make the list. I mean, we think the brain can do that like this, you know, immediately whenever I have to make a movement, then shouldn't we be able to enumerate all the possibilities too that controller has to look through? And can we do that? Do we know that?
I don't think so. So I once made this sort of heretical statement in our research group about I don't think the brain knows anything about muscles. So the brain has inputs and the brain has outputs, and that's why you can do brain machine interfaces. It doesn't really care what the inputs and outputs are, although we've through evolution have structures that deal with them. So
spinal cord knows about muscles.
Sure. So maybe not explicitly about muscles. It knows about what happens when I activate this muscle, that I might expect some sensory input, or my leg will move, or something like that. Does it know that there's actually an entity called a muscle, this muscle versus that muscle? The motor pools are intermingled, and so it's not clear that it has any distinction. So it's much less discrete than what we might see.
So what does it know
on the output?
If it's not muscles, I mean, this is, I know that this is kind of treading down an old, well-worn path that didn't necessarily ever lead anywhere. Right. But if it's not muscles, then, you know, what is the dimension set that the controller has having to look through?
Right.
Is it a set of synergies? And if it is, could we enumerate those? Even for a
Potentially, but you have to also account for our ability to learn new tasks, right? So how would you do that? So there's a thought that you could just go through every pattern. I don't know that that's feasible. We know that so if you have 200-something muscles, even if you turn them on and off, that's a combinatorial problem that's hard, right? You get, you know, n factorial choices, and we're not necessarily doing all that. At the other extreme, people say we have these muscle synergies and movements are sort of reduced dimension, and they're simple. And on the face of it, it does seem like a contradiction. And there are certain people in the field where they're saying, yeah, it is, it's simple. But that doesn't really make sense because if it's sort of globally simple, it doesn't make sense that we can only do a few things with our bodies. We observe that we do lots of different things. So, you know, the idea I have is that for any given movement that I could break it down into a certain set of subtasks and I could learn how to do them. So if I need to extend my leg or flex it or whatever during walking, that those could be somehow encoded. And there's also an aspect of learning where one person might do it a little bit differently than the other. We all have to pick up our legs in a cyclic motion in order to walk, but it doesn't have to be exactly the same. And that's one of the problems with optimal control. There's lots of solutions and you have to pick one of them. So one of my students coined the term sloptimal. We think we're sloptimal, where once you are at a level where you can tolerate the error or energy expenditure, then there is no other motivation to get better. But now if I'm going to train to do some other task, so some kind of sports or dance type of thing, then it becomes a lot more important that maybe I'm more accurate with how I'm stepping and moving. And so you can now potentially modify the or grow the number of coordination patterns that you're going to dedicate to that task. But ultimately, you have to remember that there are an infinite number of ways that we could coordinate our muscles, and only a few of them are actually going to be functional and meaningful. The other thing that I've been inspired by is this idea of sparse coding. So the fact that when you do something, whether you're looking at sensory inputs, it comes from the sensory world. When I'm looking at a scene and I have all of my rods and cones are activated, it doesn't activate my entire visual cortex. It activates very precise ones that have to do with features in the environment. So you have a few neurons representing something important about a complex set of inputs. And I would think about the muscle synergies as sort of the opposite of that. If I have a motor intention, and then I have to sort of fan that out to lots of different muscles that would actually implement.
So you've called this the inverse attention. Binding problem, is that right?
Yes, I've called it the motor binding problem of like, in order to, you know, lift up my leg, there's a number of muscles at different joints that I have to coordinate in a very specific way. Once I've learned that, I don't really care about the details in the middle. I know that if I hit this neuron, then my leg goes up, right? So then I don't really have to worry about the specifics of what's happening, and I could potentially regulate it with feedback control of you're going too fast, too slow, or and then modify various elements of that potentially with training. And so the idea is that the number of ways we could coordinate our bodies is quite large, and but in any specific movement, we would only want to use a few of those subtasks, and you therefore would use a few neurons in sort of the planning stages and the stages of constructing the movement to do it. And so you get a relatively sparse code, meaning that I don't know where it is, either in your motor cortex, premotor cortex, that not everything is active at once, and that different sections of your brain would be responsible, different types of movements.
And these are sort of like basis functions that movements would be constructed out of.
Exactly.
And then each one of these maybe is, it sounds like you're even implying, I'm jumping ahead or thinking, overthinking it, but that is, you have some room in your brain for some in synergies, and they're like slots that could be filled with a synergy that was completely learned. And so instead of muscle synergies be reflected in that, absolutely in the wiring of what this motor cortex, what motor neurons this motor cortex cell goes to or something, it could be more abstract than that. And so, until I've used up my number of slots, I could learn a new synergy. And if I want to learn a new one after that, I'd have to forget an old one.
Yeah, potentially. So there's an interesting study done, I don't know, 5 years ago with Gintner and Klassen, where they used TMS to stimulate the hand region of the brain, and then looked at sort of the kinematic shapes of how people's hands went into. So they tried to categorize a library of sort of hand primitives of how they would move, and they would use that to reach for a glass or something. And then they looked at professional musicians and showed that they have different hand postures that they go to, and that those hand postures are also ones that they use when doing sort of ordinary tasks like reaching for a glass. So it's as if they had a certain number of muscle synergies and for grasping, let's say, and that they were modified to be better at their, you know, playing their musical instrument, and that that modified the ones they're using for these everyday tasks, right? So it's not like they did separate ones for playing the piano. They modified their handles, and that changed fundamentally how they're going to reach for the glass. Now, it probably didn't change their performance in reaching for the glass.
But they reached for it with good form.
Yeah, exactly. So you can tell people when they're walking whether they were a football player or a ballet dancer. And so I think that training actually does affect the way that we coordinate our bodies in everyday life, would suggest that there's some resource limitation in how many different patterns we could use. And if you look at representations in the cortex of people who are musicians or someone following amputation, then it does follow the sort of rules of, you know, you can expand certain areas to represent your hand, which basically means you're probably taking away from something else. I don't know. I was just thinking about trying to test this in a computational way, but
so it seems like in along those lines, it seems like one of the kind of underlying assumptions in the language or the conceptual things about synergies is they're, you know, they build up over time and make these kind of core movements, and then you have to maybe elaborate things, especially if you're learning something new. And so there's one question I have, whether it's reasonable to think about, make a distinction between, say, more feed forward, even forward modeling control that is more synergy based, and things that aren't covered by this low dimensional space of things that you have to do would be more feedback dependent, in terms of sensory feedback to do new things that you have to do, that you have to actually look at, say, your hand to configure it in a way that you've never done before, or you don't do very often, or so forth. And then if you then practice that a lot, then they may become either altering or new, creating a new synergy for that. But whether there's any task that you could do or you could do fast enough to, then that would predict there's a correlation on the necessity for feedback control versus the time course of the development of a new synergy would kind of match or mirror the time course of the necessity for more feedback control or kind of timing or accuracy or something like that. Whether there's a correlation between all of those ideas that they go together. I don't know if that's reasonable or gives you a...
So, again, if you look at musicians when they're learning something, they have a lot more cortical activity than when something is very practiced. We don't know what happens.
Right. But so that's what I'm saying. So you measure the somehow two independent measures, measure the amount of cortical activity or something like that, and then some get some other way of assessing about what the underlying synergies are, the dimensionality of the space, and see them kind of co-changing in some kind of arbitrary training task or something over time.
Yeah. So we have an observation in our data that when we do when we measure people's muscle synergies, when they're doing an automatic postural response, it's brainstem mediated response that you don't have voluntary control over, that we see different numbers of patterns in different individuals, and then they represent different sort of strategies for movement. So in a study, we had young college students coming in anywhere from 4 to 7 muscle synergies and don't know why they're different. We do know that some of them were on the Georgia Tech Taekwondo team. And we haven't formally tested this, although we're sort of getting towards that, where this automatic postural response is may be modified based on some training, some intentional training on the part of somebody who's doing a particular sport, right? And so when it does get really automated, then it should show up because we do a perturbation response that's a subcortical loop.
Can you back up and just talk a little bit about this center of mass kinematics stuff? Because this is what you're talking about here. We haven't talked about the task.
So we have people standing on a motorized platform, and then the platform just all of a sudden moves in a slip, sort of like the rug is being pulled out from under you, and we can change the direction. And then we look at muscle activity across multiple muscles in the leg and the trunk. And so the number of coordination patterns we pull out is different. And so some of the people, and I can't tell you if they were on the Taekwondo team or not, would have this knee bending strategy. And so because it's the automatic postural response, it's not an intentional sort of thing that they can respond to intentionally in the amount of time that we see, 100 milliseconds.
So that's something that's limited by their musculoskeletal, the mechanics of it, the degrees of freedom within the... I mean, is that what delimits that?
So, well, most people will do what we call a hip strategy or an ankle strategy. Most people want to stay upright, and so they'll sort of sway their bodies around their ankles.
These are completely unconscious, though, right?
Yeah, these are unconscious. They're not conscious responses, at least initially. Later, we can actually modify them voluntarily. But the first 100 milliseconds, you have some muscle activity that's based on what direction I'm falling, largely. So you can't. This is done by Nashner in the 70s to show that if I look at a particular joint angle, it doesn't predict the activity very well. But if I look at the overall direction that the body's falling, then that seems to be what determines which muscles are activated at that very first instant. So the idea is that in 100 milliseconds, you would have gathered sensory information and made a decision as to interpreted it in terms of what direction you're falling, and then activated the appropriate muscles that would specifically counteract that direction of falling.
So do you see the same variability in cats? Isn't there a sort of more parsimonious strategy that cats have to sort of handle perturbations?
I can't say. So our cat experiments are really different because the cats are trained.
Oh, and that makes a difference.
So they do this every day for you know, a year. So they're like experts at doing this task. They also have fewer sort of degrees of freedom that they can change. So because they're not upright, they don't have as many different mechanical strategies that they can use to maintain their balance. Whereas when we're upright, then we can actually bend our knees or sway the hips or ankles sort of more independently. But the principles of that are sort of more or less the same. And actually, Jane McPherson and Don Dunbar actually did this experiment many years ago in the 80s where they had cats standing on two legs while they did these perturbations. And they had humans on fours, yeah, all fours doing the perturbations to demonstrate that. So the latencies are the same, and then the organization of which muscles really had to do with whether you're in a bipedal stance or quadrupedal stance. So the sensory motor kind of processing was not changed essentially, but it was modified according to the biomechanical situation that the subject was in. So
so do you have any – are there any differences between the static posture? I mean, if you get someone that like pays attention to their mother and stands up straight with their shoulders back and stuff, do you get different responses than if you have some sloucher like me? Is there anything that in terms of different strategies? I don't know if different people have different strategies that are like distinguished or,
you know, we try to normalize that in our experiments where we make them look at a picture on the wall, and we haven't studied sort of subtleties in actual the postural configuration that people take in terms of slouching or not slouching. Although in Parkinson's disease, there's actually some ideas that the stooped posture negatively affects postural control, and also that the preferred stance width is very narrow compared to what somebody else would choose. So why do they take a narrow stance even though they have postural instability? It seems like they should be more stable if they're standing with a wider stance. And it turns out when they go to a wider stance, their activity is not it's too high, essentially. So they're too stiff. And we also know that they're really not very good at changing their muscle activity in response to the biomechanical context. And so if they're too stiff and they can't change, then they probably want to stay at a narrow stance because it's easier to initiate gait there and because they're less stiff. We did a study on amputees, and we were looking at how much their center of mass moves when we give them these perturbations, and this idea of stability margin, of how close to being unstable they are. And we're surprised to find not that much difference, except in certain directions where they're loading the prosthetic. This is transtibial amputees. And then we looked at the data and we realized that all the amputees took a wider stance than what we might have. So we didn't control for it. And so the interesting thing is that they're making up for this deficit by adopting a different posture that then functionally makes them, at least from these measures that we took, look more quote-unquote normal. So right now we've controlled for that.
Because I was thinking about that also in terms of the athletes may have different postures than the non-athletes.
Right.
Like the default posture may be have less tension in your knees for someone that does something like that.
We had some Tai Chi masters come in, and they or teachers come in, and they like to crouch their posture a little bit more. We ran one of the studies. We actually had people be in a crouched posture and compared it across different postures. So we had people stand in wide, narrow, single limb stance and a crouched posture. And what we found is that the muscle synergies that you use across all those different postures are fairly conserved. And so if in this particular person I see this muscle synergy in a narrow stance, I'm probably going to see it again in a single limb stance or a crouch stance. And so we were able to identify patterns that were specific to each subject, which is why that sort of lends the idea of why I think the training is important in shaping each individual's pattern and complexity of their response.
Can you go ahead?
If you let me, I'm going to change the subject a little bit.
Sure.
To the sensory side.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Because we've been talking all about the motor side, but
right.
A lot of your work is actually about the sensory signals that are being used to calculate the change in the center of gravity. Although it's unclear to me whether there ever needs to be a explicit calculation of the center of gravity, because in your models the sensory signals are just transformed into motor signals without really an explicit center of gravity calculation that I could see.
We assume a perfect knowledge of the center of mass, so we don't know where it comes from or how it comes about. So, you know, you can look at if the sensory system is impaired, that you have impaired information about it, and that should be reflected in the motor output. But as in terms of like integrating vestibular information and proprioceptive information and visual information, I personally don't do that work, although there's Bob Paterka, who helped build my model, he does that and has some clever ways of altering the sensory input and making sensory conflict, right? So you want to do sensory conflict if you really want to test how you get an estimate of the center of mass. And so you can do really interesting things by independently changing sort of the visual optic flow related to movement versus proprioceptive versus vestibular information. And then you can actually say something about how do we estimate, you know, center of mass.
I definitely experienced that in the Star Tour ride at Disneyland, right, where you're sitting in a chair and they make you feel like you're taking off and flying through space.
Yeah. Right.
And so I was like, I just took a little weight on a string and held it out in front of me while we're going. You know, you feel yourself accelerate. Yeah. You can see there's nothing happening.
Yeah.
And so all of those things are conspiring to give us this sensation. And then, so that I think that's kind of an ancient view, Descartes view, sort of, that all the sensory stuff all comes together to some central place. The central place makes a unified model of the world, and then from there, some motor command is issued. It sounds good. It's intuitively great. It sounds right to me about how my brain works. But it seems, if the brain works like that, then we haven't done very much at that step, you know, the step where we take the sensory, all of that sensory stuff together and figure out where is the representation of my center of mass in the brain.
Or yeah.
What does that look like? How does it get implemented? And then how does it control movement?
Right. So I would doubt that there is really one place. So there have been some people arguing that through sort of a heterogenic feedback pathway within the spinal cord, you can integrate information from lots of different afferents and sort of get an estimate of some global estimate. So like Dick Popoli has measured signals from the dorsal spinal cerebellar tract, saying that if you process it in the right way, you can get an estimate of limb length and limb angle. And I think Doug Weber has done some dorsal root ganglion recordings, also showing that if you look at it en masse, that you can tell something about the limbs beyond what the specific joints are doing. So there is an argument about whether how peripheral or how distal that information is, but also I think we have to remember that there are lots of parallel pathways, processing pathways. So the thing that I use sensory information for in the spinal cord may be very different than the processing that happens in the brainstem at the same time versus the cortex. And actually, I'm really interested in this question of whether our perception of what's happening has anything to do with these automatic responses, because they could be very different if you take the same flow. You have collaterals going everywhere from your afferents. One afferent, it goes to propriospinal, you know, this brainstem up to thalamus, and so there's a lot of divergence in where the information goes, and so I would imagine there's a lot of different types of processing at different levels depending on what you need. So in the spinal cord, a lot of it, we think about these monosynaptic reflexes being just joint-based, but they're fast, and so you want to stiffen yourself and stabilize yourself until you get the sort of the next computation from your brainstem that's saying, oh, I'm falling in this direction. And then at a cortical level, you can say, hey, I don't want to bring myself up to vertical. I want to change my strategy. And so all of those may be operating on a slightly different sort of parameters of
so that late discharge that you see in the muscle that people have called long loop discharge or something, and some folks have said that it goes to the cortex, some folks say it doesn't, but that signal has embedded in it that calculation of the center of mass, doesn't it? And so wherever it goes, it collected all that information and got back down to the spinal, maybe it never even it had to leave the spinal cord because it includes visual and vestibular information.
That's right.
And so it may or may not have to go to the cortex, I guess. What's the status of that? I mean, at one time, everybody acted like that was a transcortical reflex and that used the motor neurons in M1. But
we might be back to that. So Steve Scott and Andrew Przinski had a paper on arm long latency reflexes, and they also have these tasks where you're reaching for something and there's an obstacle and then you have a perturbation type of thing. And all of that information about the environment is sort of incorporated in that long latency response. So people have generally thought about them as reflexes. And so I don't necessarily like calling them reflexes because that gives the wrong impression about sort of sophistication of information that's required. So you can have information about knowledge of the environment and task and have it modulate the longer latency but not the shorter latency response. So there's evidence that there is some transcortical component to it, but I don't know how that differs from a more voluntary component or whether it's that sort of knowledge or descending drive sculpts the sort of sensitivity of a brainstem circuit. I don't know.
But all of that, I mean, I was just thinking a minute ago that just calculating the center of mass is a big, complicated, difficult thing that basically is at the essence of what the brain does. But it happened, you're in your field, it's called a reflex. It's not a reflex, but it happens really, really fast, and so is certainly not the most difficult thing that our brains know how to do, but it's fundamentally similar to all the things we think of as the difficult things that our brains have to do. Take a whole bunch of sensory stuff from a zillion different sensors, combine it into some abstract idea that implies a movement that we have to make, and then program that movement to actually occur. All of that stuff happens in, how fast is it? It's like
100 milliseconds, and that means that the central computation is probably only about 50 milliseconds because you have transmission that's probably taking 30 to 50 milliseconds. But I agree that I think that the thing that we're studying is a very fundamental problem in neuroscience in terms of taking a bunch of inputs that could be ambiguous on their own, that could be variable, making an interpretation, and then making a decision. It's just that we sort of think about it as being more defined because we're constrained by the biomechanics of the situation. So the range of choices we have may not look as different as like when you're speaking different languages, for instance, but fundamentally it's the same problem. It's just that when you make an error in a motor system, there are much larger consequences than if you make some other decision, especially in balance control, right? Because you fall down versus even if you're reaching or if I have to repeat myself twice, then that's probably the least expensive kind of motor mistake that that I could make. But I guess some people would argue with me that it's not the same problem, but I think that there is pretty amazing decision-making type of behaviors that happen even in the spinal cord and certainly in the brainstem.
So it's certainly a common framework that you can use to answer that question in terms of sparse coding and the sensory thing, and then muscle synergies on the way out. So you have this reduced, you've reduced representation. So you have this complicated sensory stimulus and has lots of different factors, but you reduce it in dimensionality. So you have a bunch of core important factors that you extract from things. And then you have to then map it on to presumably a few core important parameters in the muscle side. So you can imagine an abbreviated thing where there's just one step. You have a sensory representation or a motor synergy representation. You could even imagine that it's the same step on the same population. So your synergies would be immediately mapped onto, like, the neurons that are giving you your muscle synergies, which come from the way that those reduced dimensions are mapped out onto. That's what a synergy is.
Like a reflex.
Then that would be like a reflex, but then you could imagine a whole, add more and more stages where each stage is doing some kind of dimensionality reduction extraction in between, and your kind of in-between decision stage doesn't ever have to arise at one place of calculating the center of mass or what to do with it. It's a whole stage of things from some sensory set of, hierarchical set of reduced dimensionality kinds of things that are important for multiple things. And then more and more flexible behavior, you go through a hierarchy of synergies to excite synergies down the way down.
Synergies all the way down.
Yeah.
Well, the other is, people ask me often, where are these synergies? And I think that I think they're everywhere. You should have some in the spinal cord. You should have some brainstem, and you should have some in cortex. And depending on where that activity is controlled. So when we think of locomotion, we know there's pattern generators in the spinal cord, and so we know there's the ability to pattern muscles in various useful ways in the spinal cord. And I can't play the piano with my toes, and so that's going to be in the cortex. But it seems parsimonious to me that you would have similar multi-muscle coordination mechanisms at all levels of the neural hierarchy. And there's this, we have representations of our bodies at all of those levels. And what's different is the degree of complexity and the degree of flexibility we have in coordinating the body from neurons at those various levels. So the most flexible would be in our cortex, but you would be in trouble if you had to regulate your balance control or walking with your cortex, because then you really couldn't chew gum and walk at the same time. And there are people who can't do that when they have a deficit in their walking, and they're doing this cognitive compensation. And then when they're having to attend to the environment, then they fall down. Right. But normally we don't want that to happen. All the students now, they can text and walk to class and it's fine.
They run into each
other. Fall into fountains.
That's right. That's right. So it's actually really important that you have those synergies in the lower part, so we can, use our cortex for things that we actually want to have to attend to, and all of the like navigation. Communication, where they choose communication over navigation. That's maybe a poor choice.
This has been really fun. Thank you for joining us, Lena Ting. This has been Neuroscientist Talk Shop.
All right, thank
Long
you.
One. Who are you at science?